I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with global attitude. This one is halfway between private faith and the universal church. The occasion is the publication of a reflective testimony titled Practicing Catholic by James Carroll, the novelist, ex-priest, personal historian, best known for the book that became the movie called Constantine's Sword. Jim Carroll is my friend. Over most of a decade, we read the Bible together, start to finish, twice, in a heterogeneous group of seekers. Like me, Jim Carroll was an altar boy in the last days of the Latin Mass, a child of the faux medieval Catholic Church. For most of 30 years now, he's been a model to me of what it means to modernize a tradition that, even if we didn't grasp it, grasped us forever. We're talking here over coffee at Jim's house in Boston on the morning of Good Friday, 2009. Could we start, Jim Carroll, as two altar boys of the old Latin Mass with the Shishipiat contest?
That's a contest I always lost.
The longest speech the altar boy gets to give.
You can do it. Go ahead.
No, you go with me. Ready?
Shishipiat. I'm going to have to follow you. This is going to be...
Shishipiat Dominus Sacrificium Domanibus Tuus et Laudem et Gloriam Nominis Sui Adidilitatem Cuca Nostrum Totiusque Ecclesiae Sui Sancte.
You get the prize, Chris. Unfortunately, the prize is to be able to go up to the Monsignor and give him the cruets.
My brother Johnny and I did that many times walking down the street. Jim, this conversation is different for me, and I hope it's a little different from the standard stop on your book tour. As a writer, as a friend, you've been important to me for a long time. I remember very clearly in a Greek diner probably 25 years ago, you saying to me that it might be time to engage with Jesus and the Jesus story. You and I read the Bible together, beginning to end, and twice.
Yeah, we did through it. Went through it twice, right? I still don't think we knew what we were doing.
I also remember you yelling at me, one of the great anathemas of our people, the humble Irish. You yelled, "Who do you think you are?" When I was thinking of running for mayor of Boston.
That's right. And what will people say? That's the other question that the Irish ask.
That was the bad Jim Carroll. Right. But reading your book, Practicing Catholic, I just find so many things to share, to talk about, to draw out with you, incurably pastoral you, as I think of you, and eternally hungry me. Hmm. And the main question, I think, is simply, why are we so tenaciously devoted to discovering ourselves as Christians? And what that means, you, me, lots of people.
Well, that's the big question. I'm mystified, frankly, by my own Catholic Christianity. I love it. I argue with it. I'm in a fierce conflict with it. I'm deeply consoled by it. It's for me, it's as simple as going to Mass. That's the practice. The practice outweighs all the doctrines and even all the aesthetic glories of the Church. Why is it? There are so many good reasons to leave the Catholic Church behind, which is, that may be true of all major religious institutions, but it's certainly true of the Catholic Church. And yet, I and a lot of other people find it impossible. Even people who, quote, leave it behind, actually, it turns out, when you talk to them down deep, don't really leave it behind. It remains a measure of life, somehow, of the past, the present, and the future. What is it? I don't know. Let me just say the most basic thing I can about it. Human beings are the people, are the creatures that know. But more than that, we're the creatures that know we know. And it's that double knowing, the self-awareness, that makes us what we are. And in the second level of knowing, I think we experience ourselves somehow as being known. Human consciousness points beyond itself. And humans are constantly looking for language with which to put that beyond into words. Sometimes it's music, sometimes it's art, literature. Certainly this is what religion is for. And And the Catholic tradition, the accident of my birth into it, has been a tremendous language for putting the beyond into words for me. That's what I value most about it.
Hmm. We'll get to that. You and I are both children, as you write, of the faux medieval church of the 1950s, really. The counter-reformation church in America, right, of the Almighty Pope, of deep but unknowing belief. You left that church and found another one, in a sense. You keep finding new ones. Is there a short history of that sort of that cycle of rediscovery?
Well, the simplest way to put it is that the church we were born into was defined by the slogan, "No salvation outside the church." We were absolutely certain of our superiority, which was, of course, a defensive immigrant culture's way of responding to the broader world that wanted us inferior. So our superiority was our intimacy with God, and nobody else had it. And that's the church that, in an astonishing way, really, criticized itself out of existence. The Roman Catholic Church is an unusual institution because it dismantled it's one of the keynotes of its power, a dismantling that took place from the top. I tell the story in Practicing Catholic of Cardinal Cushing's role in that. Cardinal Cushing excommunicated a priest named Leonard Feeney for preaching "No Salvation Outside the Church," which had been defined by a dozen councils going back to the Second Lateran Council in the 13th century. It was proposed by Thomas Aquinas and every great theologian. No salvation outside the church was solemn doctrine, if anything was. And Cushing excommunicated a priest for preaching it. And the priest immediately appealed to Rome, confident that Rome would uphold him. And the shock, and I heard about this when I was 10 years old, living in Alexandria, Virginia. This went through the Catholic world. I'm sure you heard it.
Oh, absolutely.
When Feeney's excommunication was upheld by Rome, the gears shifted in the Catholic world. And that was the moment when I went to my mother and said, "He was excommunicated for preaching no salvation outside the church." And my mother said, "That's right." And I said, "But I thought that's what we believed." And my mother said, "It was." And I said, "What do we believe now?" And she said, "We believe live and let live." And it was just that simple. And 10 years later, the Second Vatican Council put it into formal theological language in Dignitatis Humanae, which affirmed the primacy of conscience. It said human beings owe first allegiance to their conscience, which means if you are not able to be coerced or required into any religious tradition. And if you're free of conscience outside the Catholic Church, you're free of conscience inside it, too. That's the problem that the Vatican Council gave themselves. So that began when this South Boston son of a blacksmith archbishop in Boston excommunicated a priest. And why did he do it? I argue that the key to Cushing's action was the fact that Cushing's sister Dolly, who was an MTA token taker, was married to a fellow named Dick Perlstein. I know this from our mutual friend Steve Perlstein, who told me this story.
Our Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington economics correspondent.
That's right. And Cardinal Cushing's brother-in-law, Dick Perlstein, was beloved to his family and to Cushing. And Cushing knew that if he loved Dick Perlstein, then God must love Dick Perlstein. It was that simple. And what happened was experience, basic human experience, "I love Dick Perlstein," trumped dogma, "No salvation outside the church." That's the American flip that takes place in Christian and Catholic theology. In fact, it's the modern insight. Experience trumps dogma. That's what was at stake in the Copernicus-Galileo argument. The experience of tested knowledge trumping solemn dogma. And this flip is what the Catholic Church resisted through the 19th century, condemning it as modernism and ultimately as Americanism. But Americanism was vindicated within the Catholic Church at the Second Vatican Council.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask you about. You became, and this book is all about becoming an Americanist Catholic.
Yes.
On the model of Cardinal Cushing. But it began for you with the Paulist order of priests, and the Paulist began with Ralph Waldo Emerson's friend Isaac Hecker,
right,
who was kind of new to me.
Right.
Meantime, I over the years became a devout Emersonian, and then had my second baptism in a African American church in Boston, the Church of Michael Haines, also of Martin Luther King Jr. when he was a student here. And I keep wondering, I mean, talk about American institutions, the black church, mm-hmm. the best, biggest open secret in our world, I think. But I often wonder, reading this book, did we come to something like the same place, you and I?
Well, let me just make two quick points. First of all, it's astounding to me that someone as informed, as well-informed in all these things as you are, doesn't know about Isaac Hecker or didn't know much about him. And it's no surprise because nobody knows anything about this guy. Hecker is one of the great Americans. Hecker was at Brook Farm. He was a transcendentalist. He was referred to by his colleagues there, Hawthorne, Thoreau, Emerson, the Alcotts. He was referred to fondly as Ernest the Seeker. And when Brook Farm fell apart...
My guy.
When Brook Farm fell apart, like everybody in that commune, he continued seeking. And his path took him into the Catholic Church, which really showed him to be a true Emersonian individual. Because
right.
that's a radical act in the middle of the 19th century in this country.
Follow the gleam in your own mind from within, as Emerson instructed.
And Isaac Hecker's version of that same theology led him in Catholic language to emphasize the Holy Spirit indwelling in every believer, against the more traditional notion that the Holy Spirit came into the Catholic Church through the hierarchy. Hecker's emphasis was on the Holy Spirit's presence in the average believer. It was an affirmation of grassroots individualism, which is what was the core of the heresy that the Vatican condemned, associated with Hecker a couple of decades after his death. So, and Hecker started a Catholic order of priests. And by a fluke, I wound up in that order, which is why I'm the Catholic I am today. It's liberal, it's American. The Paulist fathers saw themselves bridging the gulf between the Catholic Church and the United States, showing the United States the virtues of Catholicism, and meanwhile, showing the Catholic Church the virtues of the American experiment. And the truth is, and what was the American experiment the church needed to learn from? We hold these truths to be self-evident, the importance of self-awareness, the notions, basic notions of American democratic liberalism, separation of church and state, which is a way of protecting the primacy of the conscience of every citizen, and so on. It's these basic principles wonderfully enshrined in the American consensus that took hold in the Catholic Church in the 20th century. So that's part one. Part two, Martin Luther King, he's a perfect example of what happens in America and didn't used to happen in the old country. The old country, communities and states were defined by religious borders. The Peace of Westphalia, 1648. If you're a Protestant, you live in a Protestant state. You live in a Protestant town. If you're a Catholic, you live in a Catholic state, a Catholic town. You don't rub elbows with people who believe differently than you do. And basically, your faith choices are not yours. You inherit them. Religion is not voluntary. It's a given, the same way your geography, your ethnicity are givens. In America, that's completely different. There are no such boundaries here. We come into our immigrant ethnic enclaves, but we move out of them very quickly. And we rub elbows with people who believe differently than we do. And what does that mean? It means that the absolute claim of every religion stands side by side with the absolute claim of another different religion, which means those absolutes have to find ways of making room for each other. It's a fundamental alteration of the meaning of religious belief that takes place in this context. And the great symbol of it is Cushing's sister marrying a Jew.
Stick with this Americanism, though. So much of it is in church history, even in Scripture, including Jesus saying the kingdom of God is within you, or that verse of Psalm 42, which I love, and it brought me back to something, the line that as the hart, the deer, panteth for the water brooks, so my soul thirsteth for the living God. And it comes back to William James too, I suppose, that religion is born in us. It's in our DNA. Some longing.
Yes, and it's essentially uncoerced. And that's the key. Something went badly wrong in Christianity during the Reformation when Protestants and Catholics went literally to war with each other. And religious faith became a matter of military coercion. And the United States of America was born in reaction to that. The people who settled this country were in flight from that kind of religious conflict. They set up structures to make it not happen here. There's an obvious difference now between the way in which America is religious and the way in which other nations, especially in Europe, are religious. And it goes to this. Once you set up a system where people are entirely free of any kind of coercion, the inner choice is made with much more authenticity. The religiosity of the United States of America today, I believe, is a function of healthy religious structures. People have chosen to be what they are in a way that isn't true elsewhere. And let me just say, in doing that, we also inevitably have to reckon with the choices other people make. You mentioned Martin Luther King before. The most important significance King had for me is he came into his own while I was in the Catholic seminary. Well, if you're in a Catholic seminary, one of the things you're looking for are models, ideals of who is the kind of priest you want to be. And in the old days, it would be Fulton Sheen. It would be Jimmy Cagney, the priest.
How about Bingo and the Bells of St. Mary's?
Bingo and the ideal priest. Who's the ideal priest? And as a young seminarian, you're imagining yourself into this role of the ideal priest. And I'm in the seminary in 1962, 63, 64, 65. Guess who the ideal priest is? It's Martin Luther King, a Protestant. The ideal priest is William Sloan Coffin, a Protestant. Where were the Catholics in Selma? Well, actually, there were a handful there, but the Catholics were not in the forefront of the civil rights movement. The peace movement rescued us in our need for Catholic models with the Berrigan brothers. But I'll tell you, it meant everything to us as seminarians to sit and watch the I Have a Dream speech on television and understand that we were being given the most important lesson in the meaning of preaching the word that we had ever been given. I didn't understand what preaching was until I heard Martin Luther King preach. And it's almost impossible now to understand how revolutionary that was, that we were taking lessons at that level from someone outside our tradition. It was life-changing. It was life-changing.
Jim, I also wondered as I read this book, what kinds of people, how many people, including my kids and your kids, share this kind of grim fascination lifelong with working on these puzzles, mysteries, as you call them?
Well, I think it's natural to work on these mysteries. I think everybody has a way of doing it. There can be banal ways and shallow ways of doing it, and there can be rigid and even destructive ways of doing it, religion at its worst. But that's, the human person was put here to wonder, and religion is a language within which to experience wonder, articulate it, and share it with someone else. On Ash Wednesday at the beginning of Lent this year, I coincidentally, through no particular deliberation, went to
church at St. Paul at Harvard Square, a large basilica, holds, I suppose, 1,000 people. It was packed with Harvard undergraduates, which I was astonished by. I've actually gone to the student mass there on the occasional Sunday afternoon. But this was an astonishing crowd of the most privileged young people in the world. What were they doing there? They were getting ashes put on their forehead, a kind of public act of penitence and a reminder that all of the privilege, all of the great achievement ahead of you, all of the success you've already had, all of this stuff that you young people on the top of the human pyramid, all of it is for naught because we're all in this transitory, brief passage of life on earth. And they were there to remember it. I was very moved. It's one thing for a desperado like myself to need to remember that. But, you know, these young people, you don't think of the 20-year-old physics major at Harvard having any particular urge to reckon with mortality, and yet there they were. So I think this is something we're all doing. I wish that mainstream religions were more creatively available to us and to young people in particular. Certainly in my own Catholic tradition, I wish that young people could have a sense of just a partial sense of the glories of this tradition. My privilege has been to been steeped in it, so I'm kind of stuck with it. My children are not stuck with it. I have a grown daughter and a grown son, and they're the charms of the Roman Catholic Church have completely passed them by.
Mine too, although my oldest grandchild said the other day to her mom, you know, you left out two things in our life, Mom. What are they? A car and a religion.
Yeah.
I wonder what you find on the road. Cover of Newsweek this week, the decline and fall of Christian America. Of course, I never believe any of Newsweek's sociology.
Yeah.
But I would believe what you pick up as you travel. What do people say about this ex-priest who's still wrestling with the angel?
Well, I'm meeting people, surprising encounters. I was in a radio station yesterday, and after my interview, a woman, a middle-aged woman, considerably younger than I am, tugged at my sleeve, drew me aside and wanted to speak privately to me. And what she said was, I converted to the Catholic Church 7 years ago, and for the last 5 years, I've had this nagging feeling that I've made a terrible mistake. And she said, and your book gives me hope. My book, of course, gives a reader a way of both affirming the Catholic tradition while being firmly critical of it and in dissent from the ways in which the leaders of the church are ruling it from its margins today.
Sounds like Karl Rove and the Republican Party, or America.
The way in which the marginal right wing of the Republican Party took over central institutions of this country over the last 10 years is not a bad analogy, and it's, we're not finished with it either. But it's very clear that Pope Benedict and the leading bishops that he has appointed do not represent the Catholic consensus today. They are out of it. A small example, of course, is the way in which the Catholic world generally was as appalled as anyone when the Pope chose his visit to Africa a few weeks ago as a time to reiterate the Church's condemnation of condoms, when he not only affronted a vast population of Africans, many of whom are infected with HIV and AIDS, not only affronted them by telling them they shouldn't be using condoms, but he distorted science in a very irresponsible way to say that condom use makes HIV and AIDS spread more widely,
not less. And that's false. And it's interesting that there was a kind of outcry from within the church, as well as from outside it, against the Pope. It was familiar, because he has done this now periodically, almost on schedule, every 6 or 10 weeks. The Pope says something that immediately draws a perplexed and even angry response from a broad population, denigrating Islam, lifting the excommunication of a Holocaust-denying anti-Semitic priest, bishop, the Pope having to say he was misunderstood, that he didn't act out of bad will. Well, he doesn't act out of bad will, but the point is he's acting from the margin of the church, and he represents the end of the church's effort to shut down the reforms that began at the Second Vatican Council.
So were these the things that troubled the lady in the radio station? And what did you tell her? I mean, is this why she thinks she might have made a mistake?
Well, I think it more pressing for her was her accurate assessment that the Catholic hierarchy has absolutely refused to deal with the priest sex abuse scandal and what needed to be done in the church as a result of that. What the priest sex abuse scandal showed was it wasn't so much that this relatively small number of priests had abused children. It was that the whole clerical establishment, presided over by the bishops, protected the priests instead of the children. Clerical culture of the Roman Catholic Church is deeply corrupt. It needs to be dismantled. Obviously, women need to be ordained, but the whole authoritarian system has to be restructured. It has to become more democratic. Neurotic requirement for celibacy needs to be lifted. The clerical structure of the church needs to be entirely reformed. And that was what was very clear to the whole Catholic people as a result of the sex abuse scandal. And the bishops haven't done it. And I think that was what that's what I hear most people upset about. And the bishops have contemptuously dismiss those Catholic lay groups that have formed to try to help with this. Voice of the Faithful, for example, is not allowed to meet on church property in many dioceses, which is, you know, nonsensical.
You make a compelling case, Jim, that this men only in authority is just profoundly distorting in every kind of understanding, not to mention actual relations with people. At the same time, the church seems to have dug itself in so deep with all the infallibility traps and whatnot, you wonder, how does it ever get out of that one?
Well, the analogy that I think is, I used to say what the church needs is another Pope John the 23rd. But I say now that
maybe three in a row.
Yeah, and Pope John the 23rd, for your listeners, of course, was that great humanist pope, much beloved around the world, who called and presided over the Second Vatican Council. But now I say what the church needs is a Mikhail Gorbachev, because I would seriously compare the state of the Catholic Church today to the state of the Soviet Union in the last days of the Soviet Union. The system was crumbling from inside. There was vast disorder of every kind inside the Soviet Union, and yet the power structure was in denial about it and was desperately trying to maintain the appearance of normalcy, so that even after the Chernobyl nuclear meltdown in Ukraine, the Soviet government insisted that there was no particular problem and people were safe. It was a lie, and people saw the lie. And that was the beginning of the end. And Gorbachev came to power just then. And Gorbachev presided over the nonviolent dismantling of the Soviet system. It's true he was trying desperately to save it, but at each point he saw that it couldn't be saved. It could only be transformed. Something like that has to happen in Roman Catholicism. This structure that we take for granted today and that Catholics have been taught is timeless, is not timeless. It's post-Reformation and post-modern. The Pope exercising the kind of authority he exercises in the Catholic Church today is a modern phenomenon. It does not go back to Jesus. It does not go back to St. Peter. That's not true. And a serious reordering of the Catholic Church is underway now. That's the good news. This doesn't have to begin to happen after Pope Benedict. We see it already, and this is why Pope Benedict is being forced to apologize. A pope apologizing is a signal of the change that's already underway.
Dare I say, just by reference, that there are people who think Barack Obama is already our Gorbachev, looking for any means possible to stabilize a crumbling pillar, the other pillar of the Cold War.
It's also an apt analogy. Barack Obama is to the United States what a new leader could be to the Roman Catholic Church. And as unpredicted as Barack Obama was 5 years ago, unimaginable, really. So that kind of transformation in leadership in the Catholic Church is possible. A pope who would begin to dismantle the pope's own authority, who would affirm the equal rights of women in the church, making it vivid by ordaining women to the priesthood, but more than that, transforming the priesthood itself, ending this clerical culture of elitist, smug superiority over lay people.
How do you say change we can believe in Latin, Jim?
That's a good question, Chris. I think it may be a signal of my complications as a Catholic that my Latin is long gone.
Come back to belief. Have you ever gone to the BeliefNet and taken the Belief-O-Matic test?
No, I haven't.
I took it again yesterday, thinking about you. It asks you 20 questions about what you believe, and they seem rather bland and abstract. I come out 100% Orthodox Quaker, but I'm not a bad Reform Jew, I'm not a bad Hindu, I'm not a bad Baha'i or Buddhist, right. And I'm not a bad Orthodox or Roman Catholic.
Right.
What does that tell you?
It tells me that all of these great religious traditions are built around the same ingenious insight, which is that whatever we mean by God, the transcendent, the deity, the other, whatever we mean by it, it's alive in our experience through acts of love and compassion. Every one of these religions is built around that insight. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Love your neighbor. If you want to see God, look in the eyes of the person next to you. Who is God? God is with you in the people that you are loving, serving, learning from. That's Confucius. That's Hindu. I mean, and these religions all come into being in the same period. That's the other thing that's astounding. Something clicked in the human consciousness, you know, in the so-called axial age, Jaspers' phrase to describe that period from about 800 BCE to 200 BCE, that's when you get the Buddha, the early Hindu manifestations, monotheism of Israel, Greek rational philosophy, all grappling with the same mystery, which is how we take care of each other, and how we take care of each other is how the transcendent one is present to us. So you've passed those tests and that makes the point.
You remind me of
a good Christian is a good Buddhist is the point. At some basic level, I don't mean to denigrate the differences that need to be respected, but at bottom, that's what it's about: compassion, love of neighbor.
You remind me of my Pastor Michael Haynes. We were in Ireland, a group from the church singing at a farm with handicapped people, and we, as always, stood aside and prayed a moment before we sang, and Reverend Haynes gave the prayer, and it was essentially, let us represent Jesus Christ with our love and our enthusiasm. And I've often thought afterward, what better way to think of oneself as a Christian? I also think of a wonderful cab driver who used to take me home every night, and Ibrahim, and he was determined that I become a Muslim. And I said, Ibrahim, why should I become a Muslim? Well, you're the best Christian I know. Come back to the practicing Catholic. Where is the practicing Catholic these days in prayer life, in political life, in hope of eternity, in social life?
Mm-hmm. At Mass. The practicing Catholic is at Mass. What makes a Catholic? I mean, this tradition is sacramental. The practice of Mass trumps all doctrine. We can have disagreements with the Pope and the bishops about birth control, abortion, stem cell research, the miracles of the saints, all of that. But what we have in common is the intuition that at the table around bread and wine, we encounter each other and God in a profound way. And it's food. It feeds a kind of hunger. Catholics go to Mass. What is a practicing Catholic? It's somebody who goes to Mass. Now, the reason the Church is in such deep trouble is that the Eucharist, the Mass, is built around the priesthood, and the leaders of the Church have abandoned the priesthood. They are destroying it right before our eyes.
Meaning what, Jim?
Meaning, if I was still a priest, I'd be one of the young guys. I mean, there are no priests. The priests are old. There are very few young priests coming in to serve. The collapse, the literal collapse of the priesthood is dramatically underway. Most priests are over 50. There are very few priests coming in, and younger priests are the ones who leave now. And what that really, it's obvious where that goes. It's where the Catholic Church in America is importing priests from Africa. They're good people who are full of good intentions, but that's no solution. And what we're talking about within the foreseeable future is a church that will not be able to provide many, many Catholic people with the basic sacraments as administered by the priests. Well, two things can happen. One is Catholics will begin to take charge of the sacraments themselves, effectively going back to the way it was in the beginning of the Church when lay people organized the sacramental life of the Church on their own. Either that will happen, or there'll be a new pope who will radically and efficiently reorder the priesthood. Right now, there are plenty of Catholic women who have undergone rituals of some kind of ordination. I understand that. There are plenty of Catholic communities that meet without ordained priests. I understand that. But these are all manifestations that could easily become kind of sectarian, disconnected movements drifting off into a sort of esoteric and unrelated spirituality, which would be a loss for the Catholic Church. The best Catholic people are the ones who are most, when I say best, the Catholic people who are most alive to the meaning of the tradition are the ones who are most frustrated by the failures of the hierarchy.
Frustration, serenity, turmoil, these are the...
That's the Holy Trinity.
You've got it. Jim, there are two other heroes in this book that you must speak about. One, William Sloan Coffin, yeah, who had a small part in my life too, and Alan Tate, whom I recognize as a complete stranger. Mm-hmm. But talk a little bit about Coffin.
Well, Coffin was one of those Protestant ministers that Catholics, when I was a boy, weren't supposed to have anything to do with. And during the tumultuous 60s, when I was in the seminary, he emerged as a leader of the civil rights movement, one of the few white men to go south and stand side by side with the black students of SNCC and Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And William Sloan Coffin was a prophet to the white churches. As the chaplain at Yale, of course, he was a man coming out of the establishment to do this. And that's what made Coffin powerful, of course. He was an establishment figure associating with an anti-establishment movement. Well, we Catholics were not unmoved by the witness of William Sloan Coffin. And when he came to our seminary in the mid-60s, I was astounded by what I saw. He really changed me. We seminarians, we Catholic seminarians, were all wearing our black robes uniformly. And we were gathered in the refectory, the dining room, which where the chairs had been arranged to hear a lecture by this civil rights leader, Reverend Coffin. And he came storming into that refectory wearing work boots, Levi's, and a cord jacket, and open neck. And he was, it was, I thought of, at the time, I thought that, I mean, it was obvious what an affectation it was, but it was nevertheless a kind of irresistible statement. It was a kind of in-your-face, look at how you're dressed, boys. Let's get with it. Come on, you can't go out into the streets like that, and the church belongs in the streets. That's what he was saying.
You knew that. You write in the book that you joined the police because the recruiter was wearing penny loafers.
Yeah,
and
but they
it
were black penny
something.
Loafers, Chris. I was a liberal, not a radical. What's a liberal? A liberal is somebody who wears penny loafers, but a radical wears brown penny loafers.
No, Coffin is fascinating. To me, as a Yalie in that period, you know, it's one of the great mysteries of our life. Why in the world did Yale produce a whole swath of good and bad leadership in this country out of that 60s period? We thought the culture had gone to California, but here come John Kerry and George Bush and Dick Cheney and Joe Lieberman and Howard Dean, and you name them.
And Doonesbury.
And my answer is that there was something in the polarization of William Sloan Coffin on the left and William F. Buckley on the right, both out of the CIA, both out of Skull and Bones, both deep out of that Yale establishment that defined a kind of electrical field of public action that you had to jump into.
Yeah. Coffin was one of the great figures in my life. It's one of the wonders of my life that he and I wound up being very good friends. And there are a couple of things about Coffin that I treasure. One, I understand where his passionate commitment to social justice came from. It came from a profound sense of unease about what he had been engaged with as a CIA operative. Because, as you know, what he was doing, he was a Russian speaker. I don't know that he was a fluent Russian speaker, but he was such a great mimic that it seemed to me he could mimic speaking Russian. So he had a kind of convincing Russian, and he was...
With a New York Brahmin accent, probably.
Exactly. In the late 1940s, he was an interrogator who was preparing Russians who had been prisoners of war and who were being repatriated back to Russia. And his job was to recruit from them people who would be willing to go back into Russia as agents. This was part of the so-called rollback strategy. Coffin didn't believe in it. And he reported later that he knew pretty quickly that he was sending these men back to die. There was no hope for them. And yet he continued to do it. Coaxing these people to make the choice to go back to Russia to work for the West. And he just was sentencing them to death. It haunted him, he said. It gave him a sense of the possibility of the American government doing something venal. And it prepared him then to be very, righteous in his demand for something better from the American government. And I think there was a kind of atonement in his work. The other thing I'd say about him is he really taught me how to die. I was with him often in the last years of his life, and the most important thing I learned from him was he kept saying over and over again, he said, people would talk to him about whether he believed in heaven. That was what he was often asked. And this is a basic question for religious people. And his answer always was, I don't know what is waiting for me but I do know who is waiting for me.
What a line.
And it isn't faith in a place. It isn't faith in a fantasy. It isn't faith even in my own individual survival in afterlife. But there's a way in which the sense of this divine creating presence who drew all of this out of nothing is going to continue drawing out of nothing. So my death can be nothingness. But my death is into this relationship still with this one we call God. And that's how I feel. I mean, it was in hearing those words from him that it crystallized. I don't believe in the afterlife. I believe in the after God. I mean, I believe that God lives. And God's promise to me is unbroken. So my future, I don't necessarily believe in my future, but I do believe that God's future includes me somehow.
What an aphorist, what a writer Coffin was. And that line, I don't know what I face after death, but I do know who.
Yeah.
I loved Coffin toward the end for his line about the Bush Doctrine. When George Bush announced in 02 that there would be no second place in world power, that we would intervene any place we chose, basically, for whatever reason we chose. And Coffin, among very, very few church people who spoke up, said, this is a modern version of Satan's temptation of Jesus, in which he said, you know, do it my way and I will give you dominion over everything, all the power, all the glory. Right. And Jesus said, Satan, get thee behind me. That is not what I'm about.
Right. Well, Coffin had the most sharply defined sense of public morality of anybody I knew. And the other thing that was great about him, of course, is that he never exempted himself from the criticism. He was not a prophet who stood above the human condition, wagging his finger at all those weak people down below him. Coffin was very attuned to his own ability to get sucked into enthusiasms and movements. He was self-critical, and that was one of the... There are a lot of prophetic voices in the 60s and 70s, but Coffin was one of the least arrogant. There was something deeply humble about him.
The other man I'd love you to speak about, Jim, is Alan Tate, the poet who, in your telling, kind of ordained you as a writer. There's a story there about what it means to be a writer and how you came to it and a crisis in his life. And I wonder if you can tell us that story in short form before we're done.
Well, the short of it is that Alan Tate was an intimate friend of T.S. Eliot. And when Eliot became an Anglican, which scandalized the literary world in Great Britain, Tate became a Roman Catholic. And Tate always teased Eliot for having settled for near beer, as he called it. Tate was a Roman Catholic when I knew him. I went to the University of Minnesota precisely to study poetry with Tate. He was the founder of the Swanee Review. He was the leader of the so-called Fugitive School of Poets, John Crow Ransom, Robert Penn Warren, great American poets. And Tate was a giant. Robert Lowell once went and pitched his tent on Tate's lawn. He was so hungry for Tate's blessing. So I was in that tradition when I went to Minneapolis to study one summer. And he took me incredibly seriously, not because I was a gifted poet particularly, but because he couldn't resist a young Catholic seminarian. I didn't know it at the time, but the great Alan Tate was in love with a Catholic nun that summer. There were rumors that we students passed along to each other obsessively that his marriage was on the rocks. He was married to Isabella Gardner of the Boston Gardeners, and lo and behold, it turned out to be true. And he was married to a sister. Well, no wonder he was supportive of my work as a poet. Years passed, and I was about to be ordained to the priesthood. I continued to work as a writer. I was serious about poetry. And I was feeling torn, frankly, about whether to get ordained, because I wanted to be a writer. I was also somewhat troubled by the signals that the church was going to be resisting its own reforms. The summer after the Vatican condemned birth control in Humanae Vitae, that summer I was a student in a pastoral counseling training program in Atlanta. Tate had retired from Minneapolis to Suwannee, Tennessee, which was not far from Atlanta. And I wrote to him and asked if I could come and see him. And basically, it was clear to me what I was doing. I wanted to, here he is a Catholic. He valued my vocation to the priesthood. But I also wanted to declare myself to him that I really would rather be a writer. And I went to see him. I knew that he had married the young nun. She had left the convent. And I also knew that they had that year had twin babies. So I brought two crib toys along for the babies. And I arrived at the house, rang the doorbell. To my horror, he opened the door and didn't have a clue who I was. He'd given me the appointment. But it was clear to me that he didn't recognize me. And I said, "It's Jim Carroll, professor, and I've come for our appointment." And he brought himself to and invited me in. And the truth is, I thought at first he was drunk. His eyes were bloodshot. And he was trembling. He brought me into the sitting room. He sat down. I presented him the two wrapped presents for his babies. And he looked at them with kind of horror and said, "You don't know what's happened." And I said, "No." And he said, "My son died. One of the babies had choked in the crib and had vomited, was lying on his back, vomited and choked on the vomit, and had been buried only the day before, the day or two before that I was there." And then he poured out this heartbreaking story, which was that he had gone to the local Catholic priest who had refused to bury this child in the Catholic Church because, as Tate put it to me, "My marriage is scandalous." Mm. He was a divorced Catholic and the marriage was outside the church. "My marriage is scandalous, so we had to bury the baby in the Episcopal Church." A denominational distinction that it's maybe hard to imagine, but it just seemed heartbreaking to him that his child was in this way religiously exiled. And what happened, Chris, was I just instinctively went into a long exchange with him about how Michael, I believe that was the boy's name, Michael was fine, that it didn't matter where he was buried, that he was with God. God loved Michael. God created Michael. God loved Michael. Michael was home. This is the good news. The Monsignor got it wrong. The Monsignor's out to lunch. We don't need to worry about his responses. This is the church. You did the right thing. This is the Vatican Council's teaching now. You needn't worry about Michael, and you needn't worry about who you are either, and so on. I mean, I don't know verbatim what I said to him, but that was the gist of it. And it was tremendously consoling to him. It was a simple statement of the good news. It was what, of course, I'd learned from those years of studying during the Second Vatican Council, that ours is a God of love, not damnation, which again seems so obvious, but that wasn't the church I was born into was presided over by a God of damnation. And Alan Tate needed to hear this. And at the end of that encounter, as I was leaving, he thanked me in a way I had never been thanked before. And it was very, very moving. And as I walked out, I can remember distinctly this pathway away from his house. As I walked on that pathway, I realized what had just happened, which is I had gone there to declare myself a writer, and he had needed me to be a priest. And that was all I needed to get ordained. I went on then to, and that was the definition of my vocation as a priest, which was to preach that good news. And a lot of Catholics needed it. And then I came to BU, where there were all these young people who'd come up in the God of damnation, the God of doom, the church of no, you can't do that. No, you, who do you think you are? That church that I had known very well myself and from which I had been liberated. And the good news of this reformed and renewed church that we preach the God of love and mercy and forgiveness, what a thrill it was, actually. And that was what defined my priesthood, which is why I loved it.
Jim Carroll, keep practicing. It's a great pleasure and a privilege to gab with you, to think about past, present, future. On Good Friday, 2009, happy Easter. Same. He is risen.
Hallelujah, my friend. Hallelujah.
Thank you, Jim.
Sarah Archambault edited this conversation with James Carroll. Part of my puzzle in all these ruminations is whether Jim and I are sharing the fixations of one generation of American guys, or rather, questions that reach all sorts of other people sooner or later. So your own versions of these big questions, church, tribe, belief, modernity, and God, are entirely to the point, and they're more than welcome at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining us.